Matthew, the 14th chapter, starting in the 22nd verse. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, he came walking toward them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God, indeed. Last weekend was the great eclipse, they were calling it. There's a solar eclipse visible somewhere in the world about every 18 months, but most of the time it's only visible from some remote part way out in the ocean or something. And this one was special because it bisected the entire United States, and that includes St. Clair, Missouri. So if you were here on Monday, you were amongst thousands of travelers and visitors from all over the country and all over the world who came here to experience the eclipse here in our little community. And it was really cool. We were directly on the path of totality, as you know, and it was one of the best places in the world to view it. It was an extraordinary time. I met people from several different countries, I met people from several different states. It was great to have conversations with people from all over the world here in our little community, witnessing something for many of them for the very first time, and it was the first time for me as well. This weekend was extraordinary because our folks in our community took great leaps of in order to be as accommodating as we could be for all these visitors. They stepped out in faith in the ability of people in our community, and the end result was pretty great. Now, this morning's gospel reading is a story about someone stepping out in faith, and it's one that's going to be familiar to you because it's one we did just a few weeks ago. But sometimes scripture is worth reading again, even if it's fairly recently. And this is the story of Peter stepping out of the boat in faith and walking on water, and ultimately sinking, his faith suffered a momentary lapse. Peter's story is what we're going to use to kick off our series, Stepping Out. Living the gospel, doing the things that God calls us to do, requires a little bit of risk-taking. It requires a little bit of boldness, a little bit of willingness to go beyond what might be comfortable or normal or what might be easy or safe. And the Bible is full of stories of God's people who stepped out, who took a risk, who went beyond what might be normal in order to reach the lost and the least and in order to live and celebrate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Some of these are stories of extraordinary success, when someone took a great risk and the end result was something really incredible. Some of these are stories of great failure, when they took a great risk and they lost it all. But that is what we're going to be doing for the next 5 weeks. We're going to be looking at these stories of risk in the Bible. And the story of Peter is the story of Jesus and John the Baptist. Jesus had learned the death of John the Baptist, his mentor, his teacher. And Jesus went up into the mountains to try to find some time to pray and to mourn. But he was met with a crowd. You might recall this is the story of the feeding of the 5,000, because in those days, most folks worked just for their day's wage, which they bought their food with. They worked all day long, and then they were paid at the end of the day, and they took that money and they bought dinner with that money. And that was how they ate every day. If you didn't work, you didn't eat. So these people chose to come and listen to Jesus, which meant they missed out on at least half a day's of work, and they had no money to go and eat with, and so Jesus fed them all. But from there he leaves, he sends the disciples, and he says, "Go on out to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and I'm going to go up into the mountains, and I'm going to try to find some time to pray what comes next. And Jesus was aware of what this meant, that this was the beginning of the end, but he needed some time to reflect on that and to think about what that really meant. So the disciples, they get on their boat, and they head out, and then the wind begins to pick up. You might have seen pictures of these on the internet or elsewhere. If you go to Jerusalem, and I think a few of you have been, you can actually ride in these boats. They're still around today. They're still used in the very same design. It's kind of like a, I don't know any other way to describe it other than like a big John boat with a sail on it, right? These are not very complicated boats. So out there on this boat, the wind picks up. It blows them off course. The waves are crashing. They're terrified. This is how fishermen die. There's no radar. There's no weather system. They can't turn on the news and ask Dave Murray what's going to happen tomorrow, right? They just have to. And their trust was rewarded with a storm. And so they're out on the ocean, and they're out in the storm, know that they're just about to die, and they see Jesus walking out, and here comes Peter. Peter's the know-it-all, right? Peter's the one who always has the answer, even if it's not the right answer. So Peter says, Jesus, if it's really you, ask me to step out of the boat, and I will. If it's really you, I'll be able to walk on the water with you. So Jesus obliges. Peter, get out. And it works, and he walks, and then he fails, right? Started out great. He walks on the water, and then all of a sudden he sinks. Jesus looks at him and says, you of little faith. You got just a little bit of faith. You could do this and so much more. I don't know what was going through Peter's head when he sank. Jesus tells us it's a lack of faith. I don't know what that really looked like. Maybe he looked down, he saw the waves, and he came to this realization that humans don't walk on water, that this isn't supposed to work. Maybe he doubted himself. Maybe in that moment he was kind of on a mountaintop and he felt that he was really and truly having faith in God like he'd never had before. And then maybe a little bit of guilt for those times, maybe quietly to himself, he'd had some doubts in Jesus in the times before. I don't know what happened. Whatever happened, he sank and Jesus picked him up. And we're still talking about it 2,000 years later. Peter took an extraordinary risk and he did something that was impossible. And he did it because Christ called him to do it. But the risk paid off in some ways, and in other ways, not so much. Friends, if I'm honest, I don't think the church is very good at risk. Now, here I'm using church with a big C, meaning all of Christianity, not just our church. There was a time when followers of Jesus took extraordinary risks. In the early days of Christianity, they were really outlawed. The fact that they would gather and worship was illegal, and it could result in their deaths. Those 12 apostles that you read about with Jesus so frequently, 11 of them we know were executed. The 12th, we're pretty sure. We just don't know 100%. But we're pretty sure at least 11. Every single one of them, or almost every single one of them, depending on whether or not you throw the 12th in there as well, almost every single one of them who walked with Jesus and talked with Jesus were so passionate about what they knew and what they believed that they drove it into their own deaths. And they've shared the gospel until their very last breath. Now today the church does a lot of extraordinary things. Being a Christian should be something that gives us a sense of pride. So should being a United Methodist. So should being a member of this church. Being a part of this church means celebrating and supporting our community in very unique and extraordinary ways. Our bishop asks often if the church was gone, would anyone notice? Right? If our church disappeared, who would notice? Be impacted? Who would miss out beyond the folks who come to worship? And I think there really are some very real impacts happening in our community because of our church, and I'm very proud of that. I'm very excited about that. I was very excited and proud about how this church was responding this weekend and trying to find ways to get money for the water project, which, by the way, we still have water left, so on your way out, there's water bottles, and even more importantly, for the Haiti Water Project. Excuse me. But maybe we are a little less good at taking risks, less so than our forefathers and foremothers in the church. Now, I want to clarify that I don't mean silly or irresponsible risks. Now, just out of curiosity, while I was preparing for this sermon, I Googled the word risky. I just searched it. I came up with a list of articles, and I was really surprised. I assume when I think of risk, like risky, something risky, I think of like the stock market. I mean, it's not totally irresponsible. Most of us, I have a pension in the stock market. But it can fail, right? It's not a sure thing. Maybe buying real estate, right? Jumping out of an airplane, bungee. These are all risky things that have a great... they do, right? Most of the time, there's some sort of a reward. But when I Googled risk, it taught me a little something about how we perceive risk. Because bungee jumping and skydiving and investing responsibly were not top on that front page. The opioid epidemic was on the front page. Substance abuse, alcohol, gambling, texting and driving, drinking and driving, those were on the front page. I think we've gotten a view of risk in our lives. Risk is just and dangerous. And because, see, I have a very different view of risk than what came up in my Google search. When I think of risk, I think of being willing to step out and do something that you don't know is going to work, that in fact could cause you to lose something, but if it works, the reward is extraordinary. These behaviors that came up in the Google search have no reward and a very good chance of losing absolutely everything. So I think it's helpful. We're going to talk about risk for the next 5 weeks. We're going to talk about how the Bible calls us to live, which can be a risk to do. We have to define what that means. I think we define it by understanding that taking risks for the gospel means doing things in a way that is led by God, that is called by God, still, as the word implies, has real risk to it. Peter took a risk. He wasn't throwing everything away for no reward. Peter stepped out on the boat and he risked his very life to do what he felt God was calling him to do. The potential loss was his life. The potential gain was his faith. That was a fair trade for him. It was a fair trade to put himself in great danger to serve God in an extraordinary way. So what does Peter's story tell us about the church today? Well, I think it's a reminder that discipleship is in itself risky. Being the church should mean a willingness to take risks to share the gospel with the world. And it's a reminder that the risks we take because we feel led or called to them, we're not taking or irresponsible because we're willing to be unafraid of what might happen. When Peter faltered in the sea, he didn't give up and pack his things. This is an important part. That isn't the last time we see Peter. Peter fell into the sea. Jesus looked at him and said, "You have little faith." And that's not the end of Peter. We see Peter again and again and again all the way to and through and after the crucifixion. We see Peter at Pentecost. We see Peter again and again and again. And we see Peter extraordinarily successful. And we see Peter in spectacular failure. Peter was both good and not so good. Peter did extraordinary things. Peter did terrible things. The lesson of Peter stepping out of the boat under the water is a willingness to try. The willingness to say that if God leads me somewhere, I'm going to try it. It may or may not work, and that's okay. I just need to follow where God leads me to go and hope and try as hard as I can to make it work. Now, for me, risk doesn't come very naturally. I'm kind of a risk-averse person. Indeed, in the church, playing it safe a lot of times seems a lot less stressful. Doing the things that we know, even if it worked, but at least doing them as we know. One thing that fascinates me is how we're afraid of things, fear. Fascinates me. I was in college and studying psychology. That was a science that really fascinated me, and especially the psychology of fear. What makes us afraid, and what are we afraid of? Well, Chapman University did a study, and basically they interviewed Americans, and they asked them what they were afraid of. And the results were surprising. They asked them, what was the number one thing you're most afraid of? And number one was government corruption, believe it or not. Number one thing people were afraid of. But number two was terrorism. They were afraid of dying in a terrorist attack. That was number two. 41% of Americans answered this survey from Chapman University, and the thing that they were most afraid of was dying in a terrorist attack. Sometimes, if you go on down the list, you find that number four is the death of a loved one. That terrifies them. They're afraid of losing people they love. You go on further down the list, and most of that's money. Most of it is my bills. Losing my investments, right? Losing my pension. And it's way past that. So terrorism, losing my family, losing my money, and way down here in like the 20s and 30s is car accidents, heart disease, illness, cancer. What's interesting about that is that that's actually the fears is almost perfectly reverse the list of risks. Your chance of being involved terrorist attack sometime in your lifetime is 1 in 140 million. That's the chance of you ever in your life being anywhere near a terrorist attack. That doesn't even mean killed by, right? That's just being involved in a terrorist attack is 1 in 140 million. Chance of being killed in a terrorist attack is something around 1 in 16 billion. It is extraordinarily unlikely that you will ever be involved in a terrorist attack, but it makes sense why we're so afraid of them. Because they're terrifying. That's kind of the point. That we are so dumb that we think that it happened to us. I think we're smarter than that. I think it's that what happens is so patently and awfully horrible that it's scarier than even a type of death that might be a little more common. So Americans are, according to Chapman University, extraordinarily afraid of something that will basically never happen to them. Even though things do happen, it's all news. It's actually exceedingly rare compared to the other things. Someone dies of cancer every second in this country. Someone dies in a car accident several times a second. Now, your chance of dying by walking, like walking down the street, is 1 in 670. Remember, it's chance of dying in a terrorist attack is like 1 in 16 billion. So 1 in 670. Your chance of dying in a car accident, 1 in 100. Your chance of dying of cancer or heart disease are 1 in 7. I hope I don't do that to like scare you or anything, or unless it makes you go exercise and eat better, and then, well, that's fine too, and put the phone down when you're driving. But it is interesting that like those were way down the list, right? I mean, that's the takeaway for me. Way down the list is the stuff that 1 in 7 of us are going to die from. And at the top of the list is the stuff that basically none of us are ever even going to be involved with. It's because fear doesn't always line up with reality. Fear doesn't always line up with what actually are the risks to us. I am deathly afraid of spiders, right? I rationally realize, I understand, I know that my chance of being injured by a spider is almost nil. It doesn't change the fact that I don't want to be anywhere near them ever at any point in my life. And it doesn't change the fact that we were down at the lake for a couple of days, and the dock, the lake, is covered in cobwebs all the time. So it doesn't change the fact that every time I walk out to the dock, I have a broom in my hand to swat the spiders away. Because I can't stand them. I don't want to be anywhere near them. Right? I understand. I know that they're not. That doesn't matter. I'm afraid of them. Right? Fear doesn't always make sense. It's an emotion. And emotions aren't always grounded in reason. But I wonder what that looks like for the church. How often are we okay with the stuff that's happening? 85% of churches are in decline. You've heard me say that statistics before. 85% of churches are smaller now than they used to be. 2,000 people per week leave the church, right? These are the harrowing statistics that keep getting repeated to us over and over and over again, but we seem to be okay with that. Because we don't like. If we were to do the things that it might take to spread the gospel, if we were to do the things that it might take to share this story with the world, we have no idea what that would look like. And the chance of failing at that is far scarier than the reality that for so many of our churches in America, they might have a few years or maybe a couple of decades left before they get bulldozed and become a grocery store or something else. When I was on vacation, I visited Fredericksburg, Virginia. And Virginia, of course, is a former British colony, which makes it unique compared to those of us who live in the Midwest, right? All of our states were formed much later, when the United States was already birthed. Virginia and states like it, right, they go back sometimes a couple hundred years before America. Virginia was founded in the 1600s. That's kind of cool for a history buff, right? Because this is not just American history, but it's also colonial history. And colonial history, to me, is very cool because it's a reminder of kind of how it has shifted over the years. But with colonial history comes the history of what's called the Age of Enlightenment. And that's a period of time where the church was declining even faster than it is now. In fact, it's never declined this fast before. The Age of Enlightenment was this time when people sort of felt like they were too smart to need any sort of religion. It was a driving factor of the American Revolution. Thomas Jefferson was super on board with this. He loved this idea of freedom of and from religion. And for many in America, what they were seeking was the ability to worship in a way other than what was prescribed by the king. For others, it was the ability to not worship at all. In fact, after the American Revolution, 70% of the churches in America closed. After the American Revolution, churches in America came down fast. And you can actually see that in places like Virginia. Because you can walk through a town and see these beautiful stone buildings with these stained glass windows all over town. And the door on the front says mortgage office, bakery, architect, finance, right? Because these buildings have not been churches for 200 years. They've just been commercial office space. Because so many churches left during the American Revolution. Now, in part, that was because many of them were Anglican churches, and it was the view of many of the Americans that it was unpatriotic to be a part of the Church of England because, of course, Church of England, that's England. We fought our independence from England, and so the solution was the Episcopal Church. But the Episcopal Church, that was still too close, still too much like the Church of England. So other churches sprung up, including Methodism, right? Methodism grew very quickly after the American Revolution. But overall, Christianity was in decline in America in that period, all the way up until the war, when it began a period of growth that then declined again after the 1950s. If we look on a paper, fearing the risky stuff that God calls the church to do, that might cause us to change the way we do ministry, that might cause us to interact with people that we don't normally interact with. If you were there last Sunday for the outdoor service, you already heard me tell this story. So sorry, you'll have to hear it again. But Bishop Farr tells the story frequently of talking with his mother about evangelism. And he says, "Mother, why don't you invite people to church?" And she says, "Well, all of my friends go to church." Being a person who follows the gospel might cause us to put ourselves in situations that maybe aren't used to doing. So many of us pride ourselves not associating with certain groups of people, but maybe that's exactly where God is calling us to be. There's this incredible disconnect in America where most Americans identify as Christians, and by far, most Americans don't attend church. Over the past several months, we've been preparing for this great eclipse and the influx of people that were expected. One of the ways a few of your pastors here in this community felt we needed to respond, provide a space for worship to happen that was neutral and that was shared. And so we got together for coffee. If you didn't know this, for all of the differences that clergy have, where they went to seminary, what they believe, what tradition or denomination they're a part of, all clergy love coffee. And so we got together for coffee, the pastor at First Baptist Church, Jim Muir, myself, and the pastor at St. John, Laura, who you all know. So we met together for coffee a few times in Washington. We found out there's a great little coffee shop down there that we like, and we talked about how we could respond to this influx of people coming into our community. The restaurants want to serve them food, right, and the bars want to be able to sell their drinks. We wanted to be able to offer them an authentic space to worship God and to meet the gospel. And we believed, and I think we were right, folks are probably not going to come into a strange town before and walk into a church they've never seen before. But they might, just might, come to a space that's brand new and that was created just for them. And so we pulled a flatbed trailer onto the field back there behind the church, and we stole some sound equipment from another church, and we got together a praise team, cobbled together, and we had worship. And those of you who were there, I think it worked out really well. It was hot, and a train came through. I was told that they weren't going to be running. That wasn't the case. But otherwise, it went off pretty well. But what was more exciting, this, was how well it actually worked. This was a big risk. It was a big risk for a lot of reasons. One, weather, right? The obvious thing that we were planning to do something that was at the mercy of the weather. Two was the fact that historically, even though that all happens before any of the three of us pastors were part of these communities, historically these churches have not gotten along. Historically, even these churches have been at odds with one another. And that's not the place that we ought to be, and that's why, and a great deal of why we decided to do this, because we got together for coffee and we said, this is something that's got to change. This is something that can't be. We can't be the church on mission in St. Clair if we can't get along with one another. Beyond that, we came from different traditions and different perspectives. We did worship in different ways, but we needed to do it, and it worked extraordinarily well because in addition to all of the people from the three churches, there were 80 people part of there worshiping with us. Close to 200 people in total, but still 80 people. Now, I talked to some of my colleagues and friends in other churches and saw a real influx of new people in their churches. And that's not a bad reflection on them. It's just that it's not what people do anymore. There was a time when you came into a strange town on Sunday morning and you found the local church, right? If you're a Methodist, you went to the Methodist church. People don't really do that anymore. I still do that. I love to visit churches. But I'm a pastor, and I still get kind of nervous walking into a church for the first time. I don't know where anything is. I don't know how anything works. I don't know the way they do things. But 80 people thought this was the kind of place they could come and worship, and it was really incredible. It was a risk that we took that wasn't supposed to work, but it did. It worked because it was faithful, because the gospel is differences and sharing it is more important than anything that's happened in the past. Now, Peter stepped out of the boat. He had no guarantee that it would work. He just had the faith that it would. It wasn't supposed to work. Nobody had ever done it before. It wasn't the way he was used to doing things. It wasn't the way his parents did it. And it wasn't the way he grew up being taught to do it. But he did it because it was the way that Jesus called him to do it. And it didn't work. This isn't a happy ending story. He fell. He walked on water for a couple of steps, but then he sank, and Jesus had to save him and then rebuke him. But again, the reason this is such a success story, the reason this is such an important story of taking a risk to serve God, is because it wasn't the last time Peter did it. Again and again and again in the gospel. I wish we had the time to just go through the whole story of Peter, but it would take all day, and I think a few of you need to get to Trace Torito's here in about half an hour, so we gotta hurry it up. But Peter's story is the story of a man who continued to risk everything for the gospel, who ultimately lost his life because of the gospel, and who never stopped even when it didn't work out, even when he failed, even when he was smaller than what God had called him to be. Risk is a fascinating but at times unpleasant subject. Again, Googling risk and seeing this list of very awful things kind of made it clear to me that that risk is not a word that we're used to hearing or not a word that we like to hear. But it's a word that we need to talk about if we're going to be faithful to God in the 21st century, in a time where people are ever more rejecting this gift that God has offered them, and it requires boldness. Two of my favorite people are Martin Luther and John Wesley. Martin Luther, we're going to celebrate the 500th year of the Protestant Reformation this year. Of course, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism. You get to Methodism through Wesley and Luther. And they both kind of said the same thing with different words. Luther had a phrase he called, and he said that he wanted to sin boldly. That sounds kind of strange, but it was this idea that the gospel was compelling him to do things that were unpopular, that were risky. Martin Luther risked it all. Luther was killed, ultimately. He failed in a lot of extraordinary ways, but succeeded in a lot of ways because of his decision to sin boldly. John Wesley's version of that is a little bit different, but it's kind of the same thing. It was his conversion experience. I love this story. I love this story because he was a priest and a professor at Oxford when he had his conversion experience. He was clergy. He was ordained. He was a pastor. And it was then he felt his conversion experience. He was with a group of Moravians, people from a different tradition, a different church. He walks by and he joins them. And he says from then on, he submitted to be more vile. That celebrating God, that serving God, that fulfilling the gospel means doing things that the church, even the church, is too uncomfortable to do. It means celebrating God by serving God and serving the people everywhere we go. So that's my prayer for us, that we would be more bold, that our boldness, our willingness to get back up again and again, no matter how many times it works or it doesn't work, that we'd be bold in serving God and our Creator, that we'd be bold in serving Christ here in this community. Friends, I really am so proud of how this weekend turned out for our community. But that's okay. We didn't really know what to expect. We thought maybe these folks would come early and they would spend the weekend with us. In talking with folks on Monday, because Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there were very few people here, comparatively, what we expected. Monday, there were thousands of people here. It was gridlock. It was everything that we expected all weekend. So in talking with folks, it turns out that most of them were from far away. I met folks from Argentina. I sat down with a Venezuelan scientist. His name was Marty. That's not how I called him Marty. And so Marty and I sat down. He was a Venezuelan scientist, and he said that he had no idea all this stuff was happening this weekend. When he came to America for the first time this weekend and came to America for the first time, he wanted to go see St. Louis. I said, well, that makes sense. So he went and had Goody Buttercake, and he had Ted Drew's, and he had Emo's Pizza, which is understandable, right? St. Louisans like Emo's Pizza. It's our thing. Nobody else understands it, and they don't have to. It's just our thing. But anyway, that was his experience. It was the experience of several people, right? We kind of didn't bank on that we had to come to St. Louis. St. Louis wasn't going to get the eclipse. We were, but they came here for the eclipse, but when they were coming to town, they wanted to see all this stuff in St. Louis. So that's where they were. But they came on Monday, and by the thousands, and I'm so proud of our community because we decided to do something that was risky. We decided to do something because it was the right thing to do. We decided to do something in creating a space this weekend for people in our community to experience all of these visitors. All around town, as I'm walking around town talking to folks, people are painting their storefronts and cleaning things up because they just want all of these visitors to experience the very best our town has to offer. And they were going to be here anyway. Nobody was sitting down looking through a phone book and deciding which town did the most work. They were going to be here anyway. The eclipse was bringing them here. It was our desire to give them the best of what we had to offer. And I hope that the church can learn from that. Big C again. Christianity can learn from what it means to work hard from our guests and to share with them the very best that we have to offer, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ that offers them forgiveness and salvation in an extraordinary way. If we believe what we preach, if we believe what we believe in this church, and I hope we do, that's not something we can keep to ourselves. So friends, my prayer for us as we go into this series is that we'd be bold and that we'd see these examples in Scripture of bold followers of the gospel and that we'd emulate them in our lives as well. Amen.